The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, new research offers a glimpse at the evolutionary link between prehistoric creatures and contemporary fowl. And fossilized amber is sought after for jewelry. A new study demonstrates that the substance that takes Mother Nature millions of years to create can be synthesized in the lab. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Birds are believed to have evolved from dinosaurs, and in recent decades, more evidence points to dinosaurs possessing feathers. Research co-authored by our next guest offers a glimpse at the evolutionary link between prehistoric creatures and contemporary fowl. Rory Cooper is a former postdoc in the Lab for Artificial and Natural Evolution at the University of Geneva. I spoke with him about how, by having a uniquely named signaling pathway inhibited, chicks still in their shells were able to develop proto-feathers that may have been common 100 million years ago.
Very broadly, I'm interested in understanding basically how things in nature have become to be the way they are. So how kind of life's diversity has arisen, both in terms of like embryonic development, so how these structures grow, whilst the embryo is growing in diverse animals, and also how it's evolved. So how these developmental changes from one species to another can explain diversity. And the chicken is kind of a classic model for answering these kinds of questions. So there's been a lot of research, a long time ago, in the 19th century, 20th century, looking at the development of feathers in the chicken. And basically in the lab, one thing that I'd been working on was this technique that allows us to deliver really precise quantities of different pharmacological agents or drugs directly into the vascular system of developing embryos. So this is a really cool technique. And what we do is we use a really small drill to remove a bit of the shell developing chicken egg. And this exposes the membrane underneath, but also keeps it intact. And by doing this, you can then inject drugs directly into the veins that underlie the eggshell. And this means that you get a drug that diffuses into the chicken's embryo's body. And the embryos typically will survive really well. And you can kind of see what the effects of inhibiting or activating specific genes will be. So this is kind of a tool that we developed in the lab and I've been using in a lot of different contexts. Feather development was a kind of really obvious candidate for using this tool to try and perturb.
We've heard about feathers being attached to dinosaurs, not just birds, and have seen evidence of feathers changing sort of our perspectives of dinosaurs in popular culture. Has our understanding of feathers changed in saying, well, this kind of structure on an animal is older than we would have thought?
Yeah, massively. So one of the issues with feathers is that they're made of relatively soft tissue, so they don't fossilize particularly well. Unlike the bones of dinosaurs, for example, they're much harder, they're mineralized, so they will be preserved fairly well in the fossil record. Whereas you need to have some kind of exceptional preservation for us to see softer things such as feathers. But there has been some really cool fossil discoveries in the last couple of decades. And basically current thinking now is that the feather itself actually predates the origin of the dinosaurs, because we see these comparable structures in both dinosaurs and pterosaurs. So we think that the first proto-feathers, so this is the simplest form of an emerging feather, we think that this first arose in the common ancestor of both dinosaurs and pterosaurs. So the idea is that it's a really ancient structure, and probably when it first arose, it was involved in the provision of insulation. So rather than going straight away and enabling dinosaurs or pterosaurs to fly, actually probably what it had was a function in thermoregulation. So it kept these animals warm.
So there were structures that are in the skin of animals, dinosaurs, as well as modern day chickens that are similar. Now, feathers may have changed in appearance over hundreds of millions of years, but what you're saying is that feathers as a concept really have been around for a long, long time. What is the commonality between not just the feathers itself, but the structures in the skin between dinosaurs and modern day chickens?
So obviously feathers in extant birds are much more specialized than they were when they first appeared. And that's what you'd expect in some kind of evolutionary trajectory, right? So when these structures first emerged, they are thought to have arisen as simple tubes of tissue, basically. So it's like a kind of cylindrical filament. Probably would have looked relatively similar to a hair, but it's got this this center, so it's cylindrical. Whereas in extant birds, feathers come in different shapes and sizes. So when you see an adorable fluffy chicken just hatching, this chicken will be covered in natal down. This is the kind of feathers that you use to put in your pillows or your duvets. So they're really fluffy. They're really good at retaining heat. And structurally, these are just kind of a bundle of filaments that are all connected at the base. And they're super fluffy. So the individual filaments we call barbs. And then the barbs are made up of individual barbules. It's kind of like branches of a tree. So they're what we call hierarchical structures. So these are kind of a simple extant feather types. But then as the chicken grows, it will replace these down feathers with what we call pinnaceous feather types. So these are the adult feathers. And instead of just being a collection of filaments, these actually have a central ridge known as a rachy. And then you get barbs coming off these. So it's more ordered, more precise feather types. And we have different types of these pinnaceous feathers themselves. So for example, flight feathers found on the wings are a type of pinnaceous feather. And then you also have, smaller ones called contour feathers over the bodies. But these are kind of, much more precisely ordered than the down feathers, which they're first hatched with.
So your research used a technique that was able to inject drugs into chicken embryos while they were still in their eggs. What about the embryo stage of life was so vital to this research in understanding this feather formation? You know, why not just look at a chick or an adult chicken?
So basically, the idea, the kind of leading idea for the evolution of feathers is that you have this developmental hierarchy. So you have feathers first, when they first appear in development, they're just very simple buds. They are similar to what we would expect a protofeather to be. It's kind of just like this tube of tissue. And then in later developmental stages, it undergoes quite dramatic changes in its shape. So it starts to develop these individual filaments and branches. And then by the time the chicken's born, you already have a very well-developed structure. So we wanted to see if we could try and prevent this elaboration of form during embryonic development to see if we can try and recreate something that's like a protofeather, but in an older chicken embryo where you would expect it to have much more complicated feather types.
And what were you able to find?
So we inhibited a pathway called the sonic hedgehog pathway. The reason it's called that is because it was first discovered in fruit flies, in Drosophila, and some mutation when it's non-functional form of this gene, you get a spiky cuticle on the fruit fly. So they called it sonic hedgehog. But actually, this is a really important developmental pathway that controls loads of different developmental processes in lots of different vertebrates. Myself and yourself included, we're all regulated by the sonic hedgehog pathway. And basically, there's been an idea that changes in the expression of sonic hedgehog signaling during development of a feather have led to its elaboration in form. So when you look at a developing feather, when you have this simple feather bud, which then branches, what you first see is these really beautiful longitudinal striped domains of sonic hedgehog expression. So they're really like nicely ordered, long straight lines of sonic hedgehog. And what these lines do is they tell the feather where it will branch. So the expression of sonic hedgehog is known to be really important in the branching of these feather buds. So we basically thought, well, if it's so important in the branching of feather buds, then if we inhibit it, we should be able to try and create an unbranched feather. And that's exactly what happened. So we inhibited this gene signaling at the time at which these feathers would naturally begin to develop these beautiful branches. And what we saw is we get this continuous tube with no branches. And also we don't see the development of the feather follicle. So feathers are also invaginated at their base, and they have this pool of stem cells that allows them to then regenerate later in life. And we saw that this treatment temporarily stops both this branching process and also the formation of this follicle.
So when a chick that had been treated with this technique hatched, then the feathers that it came into the world with are similar to maybe proto feathers on early dinosaurs or animals before dinosaurs.
So not exactly. What we saw is that these kind of proto feather-like structures persisted until around embryonic day 14 or 15. So this is fairly close to the end of development. But then after this, for whatever reason, they rapidly recover. What we did see, though, that was very interesting is when these chickens hatched, we actually saw that they had these really big bare patches of skin. So relative to control chickens that were just injected with just basically a kind of a water solution, which have, full coverage of feathers, the treated chickens had these really big bald patches. And when we looked a bit closer, we saw that there were actually bumps on the skin. And then we realized that although the treatment had perturbed feather follicle development temporarily, the follicles then do recover in later development. So what we had was these hatched chickens with these big bald patches and these strange perturbed feather follicles underneath the skin. We then allowed these chickens to grow for around 3 or 4 weeks. And we then saw that these feather follicles are reactivated. And this coincides with the natural molting cycle. So when a chicken would naturally regenerate its feathers and go from these natal down type feathers into these adult feather types, we saw that there's a complete recovery of patterning. So it's really interesting because what it shows is that the patterning of feathers seems to be incredibly developmentally robust. We can perturb it, we can kick it one way, but it will only stay like that for a small amount of time. So we managed to change the system for around 6 days of development. And then for whatever reason, it's incredibly robust and it does recover later in development. An interesting perspective related to this is that we did a kind of similar but inverse experiment a few years ago, where we were looking at scale patterning on chickens' feet. And what we saw is that when we activate the same gene pathway slightly later in development, we can turn the scales into feathers on their feet. So you have these chickens hatched with really feathery feet. And this is a permanent change. So these feathers will persist in adult chickens and they'll regenerate their completely normal feathers. So for whatever reason, you can turn a scale into a feather by activating this pathway. But for some reason, the feather development itself is incredibly robust and you cannot permanently shift it, at least by targeting this gene pathway.
So you can't keep the feathers down. They're really tough.
Yeah, it seems like it. Yeah.
Well, Rory, where will your research take you next? And will you be continuing to study this subject?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I've just started a new position at the University of Sheffield in the UK. And my plan is to look at the patterning of scales in the shark. So although it might sound quite different, these systems do have a lot of commonalities. So I was studying this previously during my PhD, and what you see is that both the scales of sharks and the feathers of chickens are patterned in these developmental waves. So you have this initiator row that first propagates along the back of either animal, and then this triggers the emergence of surrounding units. So there seems to be some conservation of how these structures are patterned. So what I want to do in my future work is try and go a bit deeper into how these systems are conserved, how they diverge, and basically just try and understand a bit more about what the common rules are that can mediate pattern formation of these structures across all the vertebrates.
Dr. Rory Cooper, thank you so much for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no worries. Nice to chat.
Dr. Rory Cooper is an independent research fellow in the School of Biosciences at the University of Sheffield and is a former postdoc in the Lab for Artificial and Natural Evolution at the University of Geneva. His research is published in PLOS Biology. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Amber is fossilized tree sap, and the formerly sticky substance can be found with remnants of plants and animals encased and preserved for hundreds of millions of years. A fascinating fossil found in science fiction or in your jewelry box, amber has been prized for its beauty for millennia. But what if it wasn't so rare and didn't take quite so long to be created? Our next guest was part of a team that has been able to speed up the fossilization process by artificially maturing tree resin to create a substance that resembles natural amber and copal. The Best of Our Knowledge's Madeline Reynolds spoke with Evan Saida, a research associate at the Field Museum in Chicago, to learn more.
Amber is a very exciting medium, a matrix in which you can find fossils because it preserves. Well, I'm sure many people have watched Jurassic Park, but it preserves an extremely high level of detail in three dimensions of anything that manages to get caught into it. Very often, the classic example are insects, that get trapped in the resin before it fully sort of sets. And so, amber is obviously interesting in itself. I mean, it's a gemstone, right? So it has sort of economic value. It's considered beautiful, right? And so, but from a paleontological perspective, there's also the fossils that are residing within it. These are called amber inclusions. And they provide a level of detail that most fossils that are heavily altered, soft tissues are lost, they might be compressed and flattened, otherwise wouldn't provide. And so studying how those inclusions preserve is vital in terms of understanding the biases that might come about when you're attempting to study the fossils, as well as to guide you on future directions, right? Like what biomolecules might actually preserve that could give you information about these ancient, organisms.
How did you conduct the experiment to test this fossilization of this resin-like material?
Well, so this is a method that, the heat and pressure method is something that's known as artificial maturation. And it's been sort of a staple approach in organic geochemistry, especially the study of how fossil fuels form for decades. So that's not particularly new. What I did was I approached my collaborator, Tom Kay, and said, hey, what if we scaled this up and we ran samples through high heat and high pressure, but after we had compacted them within sediment? And the reason I was interested in doing that is because previous experiments often used these very, very small sealed metal capsules. And not only, does that make it very difficult to work with, you can't use an entire, carcass of a small animal like an insect or something, but it also traps all of the breakdown products. So when you open this tube after attempting to simulate the heat and pressure of fossilization, you end up with all these nasty volatile components in addition to the parts of the organism that are inherently stable through fossilization. And so you end up with this mix that's difficult to analyze. And so by first taking samples and compacting them in sediment, what you do is you create more of an open system. And so that porosity of the sediment, you know, you sort of you compact it in a big hydraulic press, and you essentially make a sort of a pseudo rock, right? Kind of, we use clay. And so you sort of make a clay stone, but there's porosity, right? There's sediment pores. And so that allows for breakdown products to sort of leach away, and it allows for the more stable components to retain within your little block of sediment. And so we had run experiments on things like little body parts of lizards, feathers in particular, and we found that it was a pretty useful technique to simulate the formation of certain types of fossils we often call like carbonaceous compression fossils. If anyone's familiar with some of these, like feathered dinosaurs from China, those would be a good example. And we began to calibrate, you know, our experiments. So you can use analytical method. So in one case, we used a particular type of mass spectrometry. And what you see is that under certain temperatures, you know, you begin to converge upon the chemical composition of real fossils. And so you're sort of refining your recipe there. You know, the cookbook is improving. We just took tree resin, and exposed it to this sort of thermal maturation, as we call it. And we used just basic light microscopy and some infrared spectroscopy to compare it to what the condition in amber and copal would be. And we see quite a few similarities, you know, that you get change in coloration. So it goes from this sort of pale off-white to, you know, orange and yellow and brown, sort of range of colors you see in copal and amber. It becomes sort of translucent. You get air pockets in it, just like you get in real amber. You get what's called conchoidal fracturing. So it's brittle and it fractures in a particular way, like true amber. It has some optical properties that are similar, something called birefringence. You know, you see all of these sort of optical or structural similarities to amber. And then the IR spectroscopy was consistent as well with both, you know, modern resin and amber, but also with perhaps some of the changes you see in terms of the chemical signature as you go from modern resin to fossil amber. So we saw a few spectral changes that were consistent as well. So, you know, overall, we seem to have induced a lot of the similar changes. And there's a good reason to think that our experimental setup is doing a lot of the same things that we would expect in the natural formation of amber.
How does this aid the paleontology world? What does this help us also in terms of fossils and our just understanding of them as well?
Well, this particular paper, I mean, you know, there's sort of two ways you look at it. An experimental approach would allow you to get a better understanding of amber and copal, right? What are the exact changes? You know, what about our assumptions of which tree species are capable of producing amber and which aren't? You know, are those true assumptions? We can begin to test that. But of course, there's also the aspect of inclusions within amber. And so we have a method that is pretty good. I mean, obviously, it's not identical. You know, we're running at temperatures that are higher than they would experience in diagenesis, but for far shorter periods of time. And our results, or our method, you know, this sediment encased maturation method, is very good at simulating those sort of carbonaceous compression fossils. And now we know that it's capable of simulating, we think, you know, some important aspects of the way that copal and amber form. And so it opens up the possibility of studying inclusions in resin. And that's actually something we're about to do. We're going to start essentially encasing sample, so could be a bug, for example, and encasing them in tree resin, and then undergoing this sediment-encased, thermal maturation process. And in the end, we think that that'll give us a better understanding of how inclusions change within amber, right? You know, fossils in amber are not perfectly frozen in time. They undergo all sorts of degradation. And in fact, many amber inclusions are just sort of void spaces within the resin. They experience so much degradation and volume loss. And so understanding what could preserve and what might not preserve in amber is going to be crucial, because it will open up the possibility of studying particular biomolecules that might preserve within amber that could give you understanding of the biology of long extinct life. And so the problem is that true amber is, well, it's precious. It's a fossil. And in order to study these inclusions in the ways that we would really want to, those methods are highly destructive. And so if you're going to destroy a precious object, you better be sure that you know that, you know, what you're doing and what you're looking for, the method you want to use, the likelihood of success. And so by having an experimental approach, you can begin to hone those things, you know, what biomolecules might preserve in a bug trapped in amber. What method would you then have to use to extract those biomolecules to study them properly? And so that can all be worked out on samples that are not precious, because you've made them in the lab and before you go and destructively analyze real fossils.
Evan Saida is a research associate at the Field Museum in Chicago. His research is published in the journal Scientific Reports. He spoke with the Best of Our Knowledge's Madeline Reynolds. If you'd like to tell the Best of Our Knowledge what you think, send us an email at knowledge@wamc.org. You can listen to the Best of Our Knowledge anytime as a podcast, downloadable wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to catch up on past episodes or hear more WAMC National Productions programs on the news, academic study, books, women's issues, the media, and the environment, visit wamcpodcasts.org. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1810. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to associate producer Madeline Reynolds. The latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's webpage, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.